The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Pituitary and related disorders is presented by Dr. Jack Snitzer.
So we'll talk about the pituitary gland in total, and then we'll break it down. First of all, the anterior pituitary gland secretes thyroid-stimulating hormone, prolactin, growth hormone, corticotropin, or ACTH, luteinizing hormone, which is LH, and FSH, follicle-stimulating hormone. Posterior pituitary is important in that hormones are made in the hypothalamus and stored in the posterior pituitary, vasopressin and oxytocin. Tumors are usually benign adenomas. They're fairly common. About 70 to 80% are functional, so it certainly has to be worked up. There's no such thing as an incidentaloma without working it up. Microadenomas are defined as less than 1 centimeter. Macroadenomas, 1+ centimeter, can classically cause bitemporal hemianopsia, hypopituitarism, and some of the talk we'll give here overlaps with what John talked about. Headaches, amenorrhea, galactorrhea, growth puberty delay, infertility, decreased libido, erectile dysfunction, the list could go on. If suspected or being followed for a pituitary tumor, you should order an MRI of the head, attention cella, with and without contrast or with pituitary protocol or whatever your hospital or radiologic group wants to call it. But it can't just be a regular MRI. A regular MRI might miss relatively small or medium-sized pituitary tumors. CAT scans might miss pituitary tumors too, although they sometimes catch them also. All pituitary tumors require testing for hormonal hypersecretion and pituitary insufficiency. Generally, if the tumor is big, it might cause pituitary insufficiency or partial pituitary insufficiency. If the tumor is small, it's very unlikely, but it could cause partial pituitary insufficiency if it's just in the right or wrong spot. Visual fields must be checked if the tumor is large and follow-up MRI obtained, depending on what the diagnosis is. Or if it's pushing on the optic chiasm, you probably have to get a follow-up MRI at some point anyway. Surgery usually recommended if visual field defects, impingement of the tumor on the optic chiasm, unless a prolactinoma or significant growth of a large tumor. If it's prolactinoma, you don't generally need surgery, as John said, because it responds very vigorously to cabergoline. Non-secretory pituitary tumors, these are fairly common. If you get MRIs of the head just on lots of people, you'll find that you have lots of non-secretory pituitary tumors. They can be incidental microadenomas, or they could be large. They could be macroadenomas, might cause partial or full pituitary insufficiency and visual field defects that the person would know, again, a bitemporal hemianopsia. Symptoms of pituitary insufficiency might be present or might be minimal or absent, or, as John said, until the patient is under stress, when all of a sudden severe adrenal insufficiency can occur. And I've seen this happen, people who are just hanging on by a thread, they're compensating, then all of a sudden they have some precipitating infection, and instead of just being a little sick, they're ICU level sick. A prolactinoma, galactorrhea, infertility, amenorrhea, decreased libido can cause hypogonadism in females or males. Prolactin elevation is generally proportional to the size of the tumor. So you don't have to get, if you know it's a prolactinoma only, you don't have to continue getting MRIs and MRIs and MRIs because the prolactin level is proportional to the size. Treatment is cabergoline, which is called Dostinex also, twice weekly. It's more effective than bromocriptine and better generally tolerated. It can shrink the tumor more effectively, studies have shown. Side effects include nausea, dizziness. Long-term high doses you have to be concerned about if they're on. It's usually given about twice a week, but if some people have to get up to much higher or more frequent doses, they can get pulmonary fibrosis or ergotamine syndrome. That's been reported multiple times. Bromocriptine or Parlodel is taken nightly. Side effects, it's a little bit more at causing nausea, more at causing dizziness, but it's effective, just not as effective. Rarely need surgery. Other causes of prolactin elevation, especially mild to moderately in the 50 range or less perhaps, elevated prolactin, dopamine antagonists such as metoclopramide, Reglan, many antipsychotics, classically Haldol and Risperdal, pituitary stalk compression from pituitary macroadenoma. So if you have a large pituitary tumor or a non-pituitary tumor that's pushing on the stalk, the pituitary stalk, it can cause some leakage of prolactin. Nipple stimulation and caffeine also can elevate the prolactin, of course. Acromegaly, this is growth hormone excess. You may or may not see one of these, but it's not super uncommon. It's not rare, it's not super common either. I've had a couple rheumatologists and orthopedic surgeons who have sent me cases because people had arthritis of the knee, and then they took a look at them and said, something's wrong with you. And, oh, yeah, I've had this for a while. I look totally different than my picture and my license. Signs and symptoms, doughy and large hands, increasing hand and foot size, large tongue, frontal bossing, prominent chin, increased cardiovascular mortality. They have a high IGF-1 level, and they will have generally a high growth hormone level, GH level, but you don't generally need to check a GH level. Might have deficits of other pituitary hormones. They tend to be big tumors when they're diagnosed because they've been sitting around for a while. Check an IGF-1 level again, glucose tolerance test to see if the GH level suppresses. So you basically do a glucose challenge for 2 hours. There's a protocol for it, but you measure growth hormone levels. And that's where you do measure growth hormone levels with a glucose tolerance test. Treatment is surgery. Almost always need surgery if a candidate for it. Possibly octreotide or pegvisomant is another medication. Possible radiation therapy. If you can't, a lot of times you can't cure the whole thing, so they might need radiation therapy. So I'm sorry about the blurred image here. This is a before and after picture. And this generally, unfortunately, doesn't change. This person's going to have those features, those coarse, thick features the rest of her life. TSH-secreting tumor. Every now and then, somebody sends me a referral for a consult because the TSH is a little bit high and the free T4 is not low. So generally, that's just hypothyroidism. It's just that the free T4 hasn't gotten low yet, so it really doesn't matter because the free T4, as John said, is not accurate or sensitive for early hypothyroidism. So a TSH secreting tumor is rare central hypothyroidism, elevated TSH and free T4, and often hyperthyroid symptoms, where somebody with a high TSH and normal free T4 or even top normal free T4, if the free T4 is even accurate in that person, will have no symptoms or hypothyroid symptoms. And sometimes if you have poorly treated hypothyroidism, the pituitary thyrotrophs can actually hypertrophy, and you can happen to get an MRI of their head, you can see that they have a big tumor in their pituitary, which turns out to be pituitary thyrotroph hyperplasia. And if you have if you treat the hypothyroidism, that tumor will probably go away. So it's not something you jump at surgery to take out before treating the hypothyroidism. Cushing's disease, and again, this is some overlap from the last lecture. ACTH secretion or ACTH-dependent Cushing's syndrome. Obesity, stria, ecchymoses, hyperglycemia, atherosclerosis, thin skin, fatigue, fat pads, especially supraclavicular. The dorsal hump's not really that specific or even sensitive for Cushing's. Hyperpigmentation from ACTH is a relative of melanin, and infections. Cushing's disease, again, Cushing's disease is pituitary Cushing's. Diagnosis can be a 24-hour urine-free cortisol, dexamethasone suppression test, salivary cortisol, which is a very nice test, between 11 p.m. and midnight. No one test is 100% accurate. So you probably have to combine several tests. You might have to do them over and over again, especially if they have subtle cortisol excess. Treatment is generally surgery, again, if they're candidates for surgery. Might then need radiation therapy. Again, sometimes it's not totally cured. This is a before picture. This is an after picture. So that is reversible, thankfully, after the mostly reversible after she's treated. Dexamethasone suppression testing, John went over this to some degree, so I won't go over it much. It's an important thing to at least have a handle of. Low dose overnight dexamethasone suppression test is 1 milligram of dex at 11 p.m., fasting cortisol the next a.m. at 8 a.m. And the result really is, in the old days, it was less than 2 to 3 suppression of the cortisol. Less than 2 is more definitive. Less than 1.8 is really what we're looking for. So this should really say less than 1.8 to have ultimate sensitivity. If abnormal indicates possibility of cortisol excess, further testing needed. Doesn't mean they have Cushing's syndrome or disease. It means more testing is needed. Obtaining a baseline ACTH level without suppression. So you have to get your protocol for at some point you have to get an ACTH level, because if it's high or low, it will tell you a lot of information, whether it's pituitary or adrenal. But you have to do that without suppression. At some point, might be helpful in patients who have abnormal low-dose suppression testing. This can help us differentiate ACTH-dependent versus ACTH-independent. The high-dose dexamethasone suppression test, which, as archaic as it might sound, is something you should know, obtain a baseline cortisol level and ACTH level, give 8 milligrams dexamethasone at 11 p.m., fasting cortisol level the next morning at 8 a.m. Normal is a 50% reduction in cortisol. Interpretation is adrenal Cushing syndrome is a failure to suppress cortisol with a low dose testing and low ACTH at baseline. So if you have failure to suppress the cortisol with a with low dose dex and you have a low ACTH, you usually don't need a high dose. That usually is adrenal. Pituitary Cushing's disease, ACTH dependent, failure to suppress cortisol with low dose dex, adequate suppression with high dose dex, so it tends to suppress with high dose 8 milligrams of dexamethasone, and you'll have an elevated or normal, maybe inappropriately normal ACTH at baseline. But cortisol levels, picking up random cortisol levels generally doesn't help. Some people pick up a 4 p.m. cortisol because hormones are generally diurnal or have some variation during the day. So the cortisol level is pretty low at 4 p.m., so if it's not low at 4 p.m., that could be an indicator that they have Cushing's. But a morning cortisol, unless it's real high, really doesn't help too much. Ectopic ACTH doesn't suppress with anything. They have a very high ACTH at baseline. If you see this, your ACTH levels are high, their cortisol levels are generally real high, and they just don't suppress with anything. They often have a metabolic alkalosis and hypokalemia. I've caught 2 or 3 cases because a patient had hypokalemia with a metabolic alkalosis, and that's often ectopic ACTH. So the cases I've had of that were both small cell cancer of the lung. Empty cella, fairly common. You'll see empty cellas all the time on MRIs. Often asymptomatic, can have any degree of hypopituitarism. Might be due to invagination of CSF into the cella. The CSF is always pushing down onto the pituitary, and it might just actually invaginate into there, compressing the cella. Or you could have pituitary infarction, which usually is a more urgent, quick type of thing. Cellular extension of non-pituitary tumors. You can have a lot of non-pituitary tumors that just extend far enough to do something to the pituitary. They might cause elevated prolactin from stalk compression, stalk effect. They might cause diabetes insipidus. They might cause visual field defects or pituitary insufficiency. Diabetes insipidus is something that we get a lot of need to evaluate, but it's oftentimes not the diagnosis. A lot of people come in with their urinary frequency, wake up during the day a lot and not at night, or at night a lot, but not during the day to urinate, or all day long. Then you have to, is it excessive water drinking? Is it diabetes insipidus? What's going on here? And this is a very difficult thing to evaluate. But it's a loss of vasopressin secretion, which is central DI, or it can be complete or partial. If they have complete, if they stop drinking water within 8 hours, they could die from dehydration and electrolyte abnormalities. Inability to concentrate urine, hypernatremia, dehydration, elevated serum osmolality. Note that some patients with partial DI and an intact thirst mechanism can drink enough fluid to maintain a normal sodium. So having a normal sodium doesn't always tell you they don't have DI. They could just be drinking tons and tons of fluid and normalizing their sodium level. Urine osmolality less than 290 with elevated serum osmolality, and they generally have frequent urination. Specific gravity is usually very low because it's dilute urine. Confirmation, if needed, is a water deprivation test. You have to do this cautiously because, again, you deprive them of water. You want to do this in the hospital most of the time. If they have full DI, you deprive them of water for even 2 hours. You're going to know pretty quickly with a water deprivation test. There's a protocol for it. You can look up on UpToDate or online or one of those things. The treatment for diabetes insipidus is replete fluids to correct the serum sodium. DDAVP or desmopressin is the actual mainstay of treatment. IV, sub-Q, nasal spray, oral, there's all kinds of DDAVP. Hopefully they can afford it. Initiate when the sodium level is rising or in the 140 or range or higher, especially like in the hospital. If you treatment with DDAVP might be based on hypernatremia and to improve urinary frequency, but fluid intake will have to be adjusted because if you give them DDAVP, they retain fluid and they could get waterlogged, water overloaded, so you have to be careful about that. So you must adjust the fluid intake and the DDAVP as in concert to avoid excessive fluid retention from DDAVP and resultant hyponatremia. So if a person has a sodium level that's a normal range, they're drinking and drinking and drinking, and their sodium level, say, 136, if you give them DDAVP, they retain more water. Now you're going to make them severely hyponatremic. So you have to, they're used to drinking too much, so you're going to have to try to reprogram the patient to drink more normally. Especially in a head trauma patient, this is very difficult with cerebral edema because you fluid overload them, and cerebral edema is a big issue. And a patient with, like for instance, head trauma with a lack of thirst mechanism, the best you can do for these patients sometimes monitor their electrolytes, sodium frequently, and try to just have them stay on a standard a degree of fluid intake. It might be a little bit more on during hot weather and less during colder weather. So the maintenance dose of DDAVP will likely depend on the sodium level and convenience related to frequency of urination and amount of fluid intake a patient can take in. So you'll have to balance those all to figure out the doses of DDAVP. Dexamethasone in hospitalized patients, like head trauma patients or neurosurgical patients, dexamethasone can transiently worsen diabetes insipidus. Head irradiation can also cause hypopituitarism, but it can cause it 10, 15 years later. I always tell the story about a patient I had who was in the ICU. He was failing to thrive. And I was meeting him for the first time. I was consulted, actually, by a GI doctor because his testosterone was zero. And said, well, he was on the ventilator for weeks and weeks, I think, and he couldn't get off the ventilator. Could the testosterone be the problem? Does he need testosterone? And I thought to myself, well, testosterone's zero. Something's going on. So luckily, I was able to talk to the wife, and she remembered that he had a history of lung cancer that had met to the brain, and he was cured by radiation therapy. So the radiation therapy 12 years ago. And it turned out he had pan-hypopituitarism, gave him doses of IV hydrocortisone, and 2 days later he was leaving the hospital. So, I mean, you can see this, you can miss this. Sheehan syndrome, postpartum pituitary necrosis, usually due to infarction of a pituitary adenoma during a difficult delivery with hypotension. So the hypotension infarcts a pre-existing pituitary tumor. That's a Sheehan syndrome. Hemorrhage can happen, hypothalamic dysfunction, which is a little bit more nondescript because we don't really have great testing or diagnostic modalities for hypothalamic dysfunction. Infiltrative diseases or autoimmune hypophysitis. I had one patient who had a really pretty big pituitary tumor, and we were debating what to do and all that because it seemed to be acutely causing hypopituitarism. She was fine, and then she wasn't fine. So we had delay in everything, and finally, about a month or two later, we got another MRI, and the tumor was gone. And it was a miracle cure, but it turns out she probably had hypophysitis, autoimmune hypophysitis, which resolved itself. And the pituitary insufficiency may or may not resolve in those situations. In her case, it did. You get flu-like symptoms. I always tell my patients this is written down. They have a medic alert bracelet, but they have flu-like symptoms. It's an urgent diagnosis. Glucocorticoid replacement, hydrocortisone, 10 to 20 milligrams in the morning, 5 to 10 milligrams in the evening with food, or equivalent of prednisone, such as 5 milligrams a day is a usual equivalent dose. Consider testosterone or estrogen replacement therapy, levothyroxine replacement, but please remember, TSH is not useful in these patients. So there's doctors that are only checking a TSH, which is the right thing to do 99.99% of the time, but in pituitary insufficient patients, you don't need to check a TSH because it will be close to zero. They don't make TSH, their pituitary is dead. So you check a free T4, you ballpark the thyroid dose based on how much thyroid medicine a person of that weight usually needs for replacement, and the free T4. The ideal is to keep the free T4 in the top normal range, but we all know that free T4s can sometimes bounce a little bit. But check a free T4 in these patients. Don't decrease the dose because the TSH is low in patients with pituitary insufficiency. They might need DDAVP, they might need growth hormone. Academic institutions use growth hormone a lot in these patients. Those of us in the actual clinical practice and outlying communities, we don't use GH therapy very often in patients with pituitary insufficiency, adult patients, I should say. The symptoms, again, flu-like, nausea, dizziness, achiness, et cetera. One good test for this is a low FSH in postmenopausal women not on estrogen. So if a woman's 80 years old and their FSH is 0.5, you got to think about pituitary insufficiency and a pituitary tumor. Low total and free testosterone and LH in males, so hypogonadotropic hypogonadism. And remember, the total testosterone is sometimes not accurate, so you might have to order free testosterones as a follow-up if there's any question. Low sodium might or might not be, depending on other things. John had mentioned aldosterone issues. Possibly low morning cortisol, but it's not a sensitive test. Possibly an abnormal ACTH stimulation test, unless you're catching it relatively recently. If somebody just got pituitary insufficiency a month ago or 2 weeks ago, their adrenals might still be awake and alert and able to respond. So you could still have an ACTH stimulation test that shows your adrenal glands respond to ACTH because they haven't involuted yet. The adrenals haven't involuted yet. It can take a month or more for the adrenals to involute. Low TSH and low free T4, or low free T4 with an inappropriately normal TSH could be another thing.